Happy Friday, Las Vegas. This week's top news stories have an underlying theme of destruction. So let's jump in. Today on CityCast Las Vegas, we discuss the multi-day Henderson police barricade that blew the front off of a house, an assemblywoman's very public misunderstanding of a policy that she voted for, and the search for two men who were caught on video destroying rock formations in Lake Mead. I'm joined by my co-host Sarah Lohman and local policy wonk Jacob Solis. And hey, here's something fun. As of this weekend, we're airing our Friday news roundups on KUNV 91.5 FM. It's going to air on Sunday mornings at 6 a.m. So if you're tuning in for the first time, welcome. It's Friday, April 19th. I'm David Figler, and here's what Las Vegas is talking about. Sarah, Jacob, welcome.
David, thank you.
Yeah, glad to be back.
Yeah, Jacob, congrats on your new job as the Southern Nevada comms lead for Battleborn Progress.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a very long title, but it's my title.
And what's that all about? What's Battleborn Progress for people who don't know?
Absolutely. So we're a political nonprofit down in Nevada statewide, generally working on progressive causes, working with all kinds of progressive orgs for their progressive policy goals. We are what we call IE, right? Independent expenditures. So I'm not going to get into political nonprofit finance law, but I am the communications, I don't want to say monkey, but I write press releases now. That's what I'll say.
Ooh.
Oh, well, I hope you get to speak them because of that deep, silky voice of yours, which we love here on CityCast Las Vegas.
I have this mic. This mic is mine, so I will work it into my job somehow.
We should note that you're not representing them here today. You're just here as a Vegas resident who just knows a whole lot about local politics.
That's right. I'm plugged in. I know things, but I am not here in an official capacity. Highly unofficial.
Right. In any capacity, Jacob, we're glad to have you.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into the news. A Henderson home was destroyed and one person turned up dead in a barricade situation with the police. Sarah, what happened in Henderson, your beloved Henderson?
Yeah, so here's our beginning bummer story. So a man was barricaded inside his Henderson home from Friday until 12:45 a.m. on Sunday when he was found dead. The police say he was armed and making suicidal statements and refusing to surrender. Over the 2 days, I mean, this was in like a neighborhood, so many of the neighbors were asked to leave their homes for that time. On Friday, the suspect discharged several rounds inside the home after SWAT and the crisis negotiations team arrived. Saturday, SWAT entered the home. Suspect shot at SWAT. Officer returned fire. As far as everyone knows, no one was injured. And then the whole thing came to a climax at 12:45 a.m. Sunday, around 12:45 a.m., because the police brought in a backhoe. That's the one with the arm and the, like, crunch, crunch, right? That's a backhoe. My construction boys.
I guess.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I mean, we just have to find a six-year-old. They know which one it is. I believe it's a backhoe. They drove a backhoe up to the house and tore off a full, like, front of the house. Like, you could see inside of it and also the front of the garage door, too. There's video of this. And then after they opened up the house like a tuna can, the suspect was found dead inside. So it's not known how the suspect died. The Clark County coroner has not released a cause of death yet.
But I did see that it looked like he had been dead for some time during the standoff. So they were trying to negotiate with the corpse, essentially?
I guess so. It is... The police have not released an official statement about the aftermath of it or the decision. Is it normal to bring a backhoe in to just open up a house during a standoff?
It feels excessive. Apparently, it's not unprecedented, but as a normal person who's like, what are all the ways SWAT could respond to a standoff like this? Cutting the house in half was not on my list, I have to say.
No, I'd never heard this before.
Maybe they ran out of flash bombs or something.
They could have.
Flash grenades.
I mean, from what I've heard from the neighborhood, it was just a lot of like talk addressing him, you know, over an intercom and like speaking to him. And then they did try to enter the house. It didn't go well. And then they went backhoe.
Yeah. Of course, if he was dead, his responses would be
nothing.
Predictably quiet.
Quiet. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the property damage seems to be what everyone's talking about now, because I don't know if enough of that backstory is ever going to be revealed about how this, you know, even transpired. But speaking of that property damage being so significant, I guess it does raise the question that comes up now and again when police behave in this fashion to do what they think is right. Who should be responsible for repairing the house?
Well, apparently, it's the homeowner. In past situations where this has happened, the homeowner is on the hook whether or not they were involved with the crime. And this wasn't this guy's townhome, I guess. It belonged to someone else. So they
are... Oh, sweet.
Yeah. So
they were just Airbnb-ing it out. Oh, they came back. They're like, oh, you're going to lose your deposit, bro.
Exactly. So, like, on the one hand, and I'll say in my experience, I covered the shooting that happened at UNLV. And as part of that, you know, everyone was sheltering in place. And when Metro came and cleared every building at UNLV, they did it one by one and basically used battering rams to break every single door on UNLV's campus. And UNLV was on the hook for replacing all or fixing all of that damage, right? That's not, Metro is not going to pay for that. It's UNLV had to. Now, they had insurance to do that. I assume if a homeowner has insurance, maybe this is, I don't know if an act of police counts as an act of God, but...
policy would this be covered under? Yeah, exactly. Is it act of God?
Well, if you talk to some police officers, they would say it is.
Could be. But yeah, hopefully the insurance will cover such a thing, but one wonders where in the policy the police coming in with a backhoe is.
Yeah, and if, I mean, the house is severely structurally damaged. It looked like, you know, I'm from the Midwest, it looked like a house... after a tornado, literally. Like, that's the only time I've seen...
In insurance terms, it might be totaled.
Yeah, exactly. That it has to be totally torn down, and then who knows what. You know, it's part of a planned community where all the houses look the same. I mean, what a literal mess.
Yeah, an actual literal mess.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the limits of when and how private individuals should bear the costs of what comes down to being public safety? When does it make sense and when does it not?
This seems extraordinarily excessive. Like, why isn't there a fund? You know, the police are given billions of dollars in this country individually in individual cities. Why isn't a portion of that being set aside to offset the cost of, you know, what maybe could be said are like unprecedented circumstances? Maybe they did this as a plan to hopefully recover this individual alive, and that wasn't the case. But why isn't there a fund for this poor homeowner? Or the HOA that now has to deal with these really, what is going to be a really expensive repair or tear down.
Absolutely. It feels like there are other places. So, for instance, the state has a money set aside to settle lawsuits with people because former employees or people who get into beef with the state over whatever sue and get awarded damages. So the state always has money set aside to pay for that kind of stuff. I don't know why such a fund couldn't exist for this exact same kind of thing. If we're going to acknowledge that sometimes the police are going to cause property damage in the course of their job, sometimes is inevitable, right? I think back to the UNLV thing. I don't know. It is what it is. Then there should be some kind of mechanism by which people don't have to bear the burden of, okay, well, now that the police have left, I'm on the hook for half a house here.
They're already dealing with often a traumatic or criminal incident, like in, you know, a UNLV is an institution, not an individual, certainly very traumatic, but like to be affected by criminal actions, to be affected by trauma, and then have to foot the bill of half of your house missing is pretty horrific.
Now, there are certain limits of immunity, which is, you know, pretty generous for the police doing what the police are trained and what the public relies on them to do. So like when police pull over cars and they suspect that there might be drugs somewhere in the vehicle, they could dismantle the entire thing. And even if they turn out wrong, they don't have to pay for it. But if there was like a high-speed pursuit and cars weren't doing anything wrong, they were just even pulled to the side of the road or whatever, and they get damaged or a person gets injured, there is insurance to cover that. So they wouldn't be off the hook if like a police car just slammed into somebody doing a police pursuit and the driver wasn't doing anything wrong. You know, they're going to be on the hook for that. But it does sort of raise a lot of issues about the consequences of police conduct, not just financially for innocent bystanders who are impacted, but even for the targets, especially if they turn out to not be engaged in any wrongdoing. Like Jacob said, I mean, you know, this wasn't even this guy's house. Sometimes they pursue people or go to the wrong houses or whatever, and they just don't feel like they should have to pay for that.
I mean, I really would have liked this story to turn out like the story we discussed the other week, where at least the man who was, you know, making suicidal statements and making threatening things, the dog story, like everyone came out alive in the end of that. So like the real heartbreak of this story is that the suspect was found dead. And again, we don't know why at this point, but I also wouldn't be surprised if the homeowner sued the police.
He's not going to do well, I don't think.
I think this story has really caught people's attention because it's a pretty shocking thing that was their decision process, that the next step to keep. I mean, I understand that the SWAT team was shot at when they entered the house, but like usually backhoe isn't the solution.
Okay, let's move to our second story. Assemblyperson Danielle Gallant had some choice comments on the videos and the social medias about how cool it is that the A's are coming, and there seems to be a little bit of a clapback. What happened there, Jacob?
Yeah, in what appears to be an incredibly unforced error on Assemblywoman Danielle Gallant's part, she has been making a ton of these like TikTok videos or Twitter videos, just, you know, putting herself out there for her campaign. Very modern way to run a campaign, I'll say this. Now, what she did do here was she made a video about how actually everyone's got it wrong on the A's, and Nevada / Las Vegas is not, all caps, paying for the stadium that they're going to build, despite the fact that there's about $300 million in public money, including a waterfall in bonds. But we're going to ignore that. She basically said that because everyone's going to benefit economically from the A's being here, that mm-hmm. like, you know, tourists are going to come and all that kind of stuff, that it's not really public funding. So actually the taxpayers win. She was promptly ratioed, a classic L ratio situation. And a bunch of people, mostly A's fans, showed up in her mentions to be like, actually, this is the mechanics of the bill. Now, she backed off and said, oh, all right. You know what? A lot of people reached out to me to correct. I may have had a misunderstanding about the way the bill worked, but she said she still supported it. And, you know, she said, I'll quote here rather, that she's grateful to those who have corrected her respectfully and that mm-hmm. their input has spurred her to delve deeper and better understand the nuances of the financial arrangements involved. We should note that today is, almost a year. We'll call it 10 months after they passed the bill. And she voted for it. To those, quote, to those who chose to criticize less constructively, I hope future errors.
To the haters,
I hope future errors you make are met with more kindness than some of the responses I received, which is, I think, fair. I think some people were pretty mean to her.
Wait, people were mean to a woman on the internet? Stop.
Yeah, it is. I know. It's shocking.
That was sarcasm.
I know. So, but yes, I mean, that's the lay of the land here, that she very publicly got it wrong and then very publicly apologized. And now we're here.
And yeah, and she keeps putting out these videos, though. I mean, at some point, you probably should cut your losses, Assemblywoman. But the newest one is like, and for all those people saying that they paid me off, and then she goes on this rant about how it was okay to take money from the A's after the fact because she didn't know that they were, and that campaigns are expensive, y'all. And we absolutely should take money for whoever wants to give it to us, even if we don't vote for their thing, though I did vote for their thing, blah, 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 blah. I want to focus for a second on her apology video/tweet. It did seem to be a sincere-ish apology. It certainly acknowledged that she made errors, though she didn't specify what errors she made, which is always a little suspect to me. But the replies turned out to be very split to that apology video. Some people said, well, that was important and even admirable for a public official to admit when they're wrong, be open and honest like this. Others say, well, it's still upsetting, even shocking, that an elected official who voted on this very issue appears to have very deeply misunderstood a pillar of that policy. So who's right?
Well,
both can be true, right?
Yeah.
We can hold both in our hand.
Can they? Did I just set up a both can be right scenario? Did I need to ask a better question?
I think it's the answer lies somewhere in the middle, because really, to me, this is the most revealing thing we could have had happen for normal people to understand the consequences of having a citizen legislature. Like Nevada Constitution, look at what you have wrought, because this is it. Lawmakers are regular people like you and me. They're probably richer than you and me. Sorry. But other than that, they have normal day jobs. They are not professional legislators. years. They do not have staffs, really. They have like a caucus staff, which is like a couple of people, but they do not have many, many underlings who can help them digest policy when they're taking meetings. They're taking meetings personally. They're usually non-experts on most things. And frankly, a lot of state policy is extremely complicated. If you are not a lawyer, if you are not an accountant, then good luck. Because a lot of this stuff is insanely complicated. I mean, the state budget is billions of dollars, right? And so when you put these non-experts in this situation, the people who have power are lobbyists, are donors, are people who do understand these issues and are getting in there and putting themselves in front of legislators.
Jacob, I absolutely want to talk about the limitations of a citizen legislature, but I don't want to let this tweeting kind of go uncommented on, especially Sarah. I know you have some views on this. The way that it was sort of all unfolded, the coming in, the apology, the re-apology, the maybe it was an apology. How does all that play to you as just a citizen looking at your legislator, who also represents Henderson, by the way?
Listen, I'm not familiar with Gallant's, you know, record. Career as a whole. I've lived here less than 3 years. I don't think I even got the chance to vote for her, although it sounds like I will, depending on what district she represents. You know, in this isolated incident, does she come off like kind of an idiot? Absolutely.
Ouch.
But like, everybody is an idiot sometimes, whether you are a citizen legislature or a professional, you know, career legislature, right? And initially, I think she did her damn best to kind of respond to it in that she didn't double down, which is always something that I appreciate when, especially in this online world, when a mistake is pointed out, that is a true mistake, that someone says, you're right, I was wrong, I had a gross misunderstanding of what this was a mistake. I actually think that that really does hold a lot of weight. Again, like, this could keep going on to, like, maybe she's not a great representative, I don't know, but only looking at this one incident, I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, you messed up, maybe that affected us, but, like, I hold the citizen legislatures, honestly, to the same standards as I do the career ones, because I think that there's advantages and disadvantages to both. And I think that there are people who are career legislators that are absolute idiots and have gotten there based on their wealth and bravado. And I think that there are citizen legislatures that are brilliant people, and it's important that they're engaged in careers and in the community too.
Yeah, I mean, this person, I looked on the website, seems like they have a real estate penchant, which is suggesting to me that this is a Republican. I know it's a Republican.
Oh, she's a Republican, yeah.
Yeah. Also, apparently was a therapist at some point, too. Although, you know, some of the language was a little incendiary. I mean, you know, what I think the A's fans kind of jumped on here was that in other videos talking about this very subject, she was being very pro-Las Vegas and was being very derogatory towards A's. She was saying, well, it's good that they're coming here because they're getting rid of the quote-unquote stank of Oakland off of them, which is really rough. I mean, so someone who's asking for civil discourse was getting a little pushback for maybe not being so civil in very recent memory. I mean, Jacob, let's just go back to the point that you brought up. Nevada has a citizen legislature. Is this a prime example of why we shouldn't?
Well, this is one of many examples why we shouldn't. Or if we have a citizen legislature, at least a legislature that meets more regularly or is like quasi-professionalized, it'll never happen. Nevadans, as a matter of principle, do not want to fund the legislature. Every time the discussion of an annual legislative session comes up, it is immediately shot down. No one likes the idea of paying someone to be a lawmaker because it feels like corruption. But the opposite, in my experience, is true. Like, I think what everyone should do is at the end of the legislative session, there is a period of time where they need to get everything passed and they can't actually do it through regular committee processes. So they do these like, they'll literally huddle in the hallways and they'll just like, lawmakers will just hold up bills and be like, we're going to pass this. It's like, we're going to pass this. And it's been amended to hell and back and you don't know what's inside of it, but they just passed it.
Citizens who might want to have public comment don't know.
Yeah. Who knows whenever they reprint the bill and it's like, journalists don't know. Other lawmakers don't know. It's a huge mess.
And this is basically the rush at the end of our very short legislative session. Is that's what's happening, Jacob?
Exactly. And the people who have power in that scenario, again, are it's the Legislative Council Bureau who helps write and draft those bills. They have the legal expertise to make that language in the first place. And lobbyists who have the sort of technical expertise that legislators don't have. And that's a good and a bad thing. And it is what it is.
Fair.
I think that there's a couple of things going on here. And I think we do have to stop talking about like a citizen legislature is not being capable of understanding. Either the three of us are citizens, we could run for office and we would be able to understand this legislation, right? And maybe the fault isn't on the individual, but also in the fact that, as Jacob rightly pointed out, like you don't get a staff, you don't get money. So while our system does need to have an overhaul, I actually think the way Las Vegas legislature is set up is really important to how the state has evolved, especially over the last decade. Because as you two well know, the majority of our state legislature are women, and more than half of those women are mothers. It is very difficult for a woman, especially a mother, to be a career politician, because even though it is the 21st century, we still get third shift. We still take care of the home. We still don't get as far ahead in our careers. We still don't make as much money over the length of our careers, especially if we have children. So the fact that we have this woman-run legislature that has passed progressive policies within Nevada and will continue to do so is because we have a citizen legislature that only meets for a very restricted number of days. So how do we keep the system that is clearly allowing women to have a say in state politics that benefits all of us in the state and make sure they have the opportunity to understand these bills in depth?
Let's accord all this and make a better citizen legislature. Are we all on the same page on that one?
Oh, yeah. No, if I were king for a day, I have so many ideas.
All right, moving into our final category of destruction. Two men have been caught on video destroying rock formations at Lake Mead. Ugh, this is an all too familiar scenario. This time we actually have that video of two grown-ass men having a good old time toppling ancient rock formations at the Redstone Dunes Trail, which is a part of the Lake Mead recreational area. People in the valley are probably familiar with these gorgeous natural wonders. And here it looks like just for the funsie of watching big rocks go boom, these jerks, one who's wearing trademark sunglasses on the top of his head, show off for the camera while what appears to be a child is very frightened behind them, sort of scurrying. Besides, of course, this being very dangerous for everyone involved, including that child, it has been described as, quote, millions of years of geologic history pulverized in seconds. As of this taping, park rangers are still looking for the culprits.
Yeah, people can look for videos if they can help. You know, listen, I'm always shocked by these stories because it just shows how little understanding there is to respecting everything in the national park, even if you see it as just rocks. And I don't understand where that miseducation is coming from. But then when I started thinking about the history of these incidents, like I think the other really bad one was at Goblin Valley in Utah. And it was about a decade ago, but the men were found and prosecuted of the same thing. They were leaders. They were Boy Scout, like troop leaders, adult men kicking rocks over. So I guess my question, while I'm so angry this morning already about every effed up thing that's happening, Jacob and David, as men, why are men doing this? What motivates men to kick over rocks all the time?
Oh, God. Because they're there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was my trying to approximate what men would say. I don't know that I'm naturally embraced as one of them on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
With my indoor cat interests.
Hashtag not all men.
Thank you.
But there's got to be some sort of social over umbrella, some way that we're raising men or that men are walking through the world that they feel like it's fun to not only create this kind of destruction, but then film it, y'all. What's up?
Fellow man, Jacob, please take this.
So I don't know enough about Freudian psychology to actually put a name to it, but I'm sure it's in there somewhere. I'll call it the death drive, but for pushing rocks over. There is something about the male urge to watch something be destroyed and to destroy it with your own hands. This is the small child with a magnifying glass over an anthill, you know, like this is I must see something explode if I can. And it's much better if I get to do it.
Yeah.
This is David Letterman dropping watermelons off of a 10-story building.
Yeah.
That's better.
If you're not the watermelon.
It's teenagers egging cars. It's the same. I think there is a destructive impulse that I'm sure there's some kind of deep-seated, Freudian psychological root too, but I don't know enough about Freud to say.
It's actually a great explanation, Jacob.
Well, I certainly hope so.
You know, there's a lot of vandalism, and I would include this in vandalism, even though I would assume that the people doing it don't think of it as such. But we see a lot of this, especially on those beautiful old rock formations here in the valley.
Yeah.
A lot of graffiti, and I don't know that's all just men. Just to stand up for mankind for a second.
Oh, no. And I don't think in general that it, you know, certainly women occasionally participate in this sort of behavior, too. And actually, in the terms of, like, painting graffiti, I mean, how is that different from, like, ancient rock painting, right? We do also have this urge to paint on something. That's a whole nother episode, right?
Jimmy Loves Susie on a million-year-old thing is, like, not always the best. Or, like, gang stuff or...
That could, we don't know if like those 1,000-year-old paintings.
They could be gang stuff. They could have been.
No, it could be Jimmy Loves Susie.
They could be gang stuff.
Yeah, it could be gang stuff. We don't know. But like, is the destructive urge, which does seem to be very male oriented or let's say testosterone oriented, right? Like, is that, or is it nature versus nurture? I guess that's the better question.
I wonder if it's less the urge itself and the ability to resist the urge to do the
Ooh,
thing.
Ooh, that is true.
Because it's like, you know, when you stand in like a tall building and you look down.
Yeah, you get that feeling of like, am I going to get sucked over the side or should I jump over the side? Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like when you see a big rock teetering on a smaller rock, you're like, what would happen if I just pushed it? And like, obviously, you shouldn't push the rock. But what if you did?
I mean, that is hits on something, because I will say that being raised as a woman, we are taught to de-escalate situations. So like part of our nature as being raised societally as caregivers is to not destroy and to repress those urges and also to talk those urges down out of other people. David, Jacob is showing you up here. Jacob understands men.
I'm plugged in. I'm in the manosphere.
I will never understand the human condition, let alone that half of it. But, you know, we do see this a lot. And the one that instantly jumped to my memory was the pupfish incident out at Crystal.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Where just drunken idiots went into the water and, you know, effed around and found out. They endangered like one of the most precious, fragile species in the world, the devil pupfish that's out there.
That lives in one hole. Yeah, they went swimming with like sunscreen on. And the other concern was like, they lay their eggs on these little shelves. And so, like, when you jump down in there, you, like, smash baby pupfish eggs. Yeah, and they got fined or arrested, too. Do you remember?
Yeah, they turned themselves in, which was probably the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I was looking up back in 2018, the one fella went in there. He got a sentence of 12 months and a day in custody. 9 months of that was specifically for violating the Endangered Species Act. He had to pay $14,000 in restitution to the National Park Service, along with a fine of $1,000. And he was also forbidden to enter federal public lands for the rest of his life.
And let's be clear, for those of you who don't know, they didn't swim in a swim hole by accident. Like, Devil's Hole.
Oh, they had to get around it all.
Yeah. They had to climb a fence, too. By the way, to shout out another podcast, Criminal with Phoebe Judge did a whole episode about this that went in deep and was really fascinating.
Yeah. So, let's go this way, because we usually try to have a little fun. This has been kind of a downer episode, but we try to have a little fun. If you were a parks official, besides the jail time and the fines that they could face, what other measures would you implement to stop or try to prevent people or really just punish them for vandalizing vulnerable and ancient rock formations?
Well, if we're talking about rock formations, obviously the Greeks had it right. Sisyphus is our guide here.
Oh, my God.
You got to push it back up the hill. Push it back up the hill. And then there's because there's a small child at the top of the hill who's ready to push it back down. So then you got to go get it again.
That's a brilliant answer.
Sisyphusian punishments. I love it.
Oh, my God.
Or do
I?
I do. I'm really like reevaluate punishment person here. I'm an abolitionist. But that feels right. How about you, Sarah?
I mean, I tried to think of something funny, but like for me, I was just like, clearly we're missing something within our education that we don't understand that the joy of these public spaces is every single item inside of them, including the rocks. Like, it's fun to kick rocks in other places, I guess, but why don't people know, not that it's illegal to do this, but that you shouldn't do this within these spaces? So my boring, not funny answer is like, we're clearly there's a gap in our education of our understanding of public spaces. And should I say, especially national parks too, that they want to give us unfettered contact with nature. So you can't get close enough to that rock to kick it over unlike in other spaces, but you shouldn't. The national parks is one of the few places that doesn't protect us from ourselves, so we have to do better. So sorry, that's a rant, not a joke. I'll try better next week.
That was a rant, not a joke. Okay, so now it's up to me. So they have to, for the next 10 years, whenever they're out in public, wear a chain around their neck with a rock, a sizable rock, not one that's going to be uncomfortable or cause any neck problem,
okay,
but just big enough that people would be like, why are you carrying a rock around, Flavor Flav style? And they would then be required to tell the truth. And if anyone caught them telling a lie, that there would be additional punishment. So they would be known as the rock guy.
But what if that becomes a fashion trend and then people are kicking rocks just to get the rock?
It couldn't be. It would be.
David, never say never.
Oh, no. There's got to be a way. So the rock's radioactive and they're dying slowly of cancer. What do you want from me? What do you want from me, Sarah? I was trying to make a goof.
David, so vindictive.
I was trying to make a goof. No one's going to pick up on this rock fad.
You don't know that.
Because it's a shame. It's an act of shame. Ugh. Sarah, let me have my punishments.
Junkos are back. Those giant pants from the 90s that if you live in a snowy area, it sucks ice and mud water up to your knees. Kids are wearing those again. So if Junkos are back.
Whatever. You also have to wear bell-bottom jeans. You have to wear what's out of fashion at the same time. And the rock. Come on.
The rock is all crucial. Right.
Hey, you guys, we got to get running. One last thing before we go. We want to make sure that you tune in on Monday for the launch of our new series, and we're calling it Mayoral Mondays. There probably will not be reverb on it. Sarah, what is the first episode all about?
Yeah, I got to sit down with Steve Sibelius. He's the senior political reporter for Channel 13. Oh my God, does he know his stuff? He's been reporting in Vegas for years and years and years. We did an overview, especially because, as we all know, I live in Henderson. So the mayor doesn't even represent me. I can't vote for it, but it's still a discussion that affects the whole valley. So we really dug into the why. Why is the mayor of Las Vegas important, even if you're one of the 1.7 million people who is not represented by that mayor? And also, we just took a look at some of the candidates and how this race is different, and also how the kind of legacy the Goodmans are leaving behind.
And we've got a slate of interviews with actual mayoral candidates ready to go, too. So make sure to tune in every Monday until the election. Well, Sarah, Jacob, thanks for joining us here on another Friday News Roundup on CityCast Las Vegas.
Thanks so much for having me.
See you next week.
That's all for today here on CityCast Las Vegas. Our producers this week were Sonia Cho Swanson, Layla Muhammad, and AK Al Moomin. Our newsletter editor is Rob Catchelreese, and our hosts are Sarah Lohman and me, David Figler. Music is by OG Moose, Epidemic Sound, and All the Kimonos. We record the show on the traditional homelands of the Nuuvi, the Southern Paiute people. If this is your first time tuning in, well, welcome. And guess what? You can subscribe to our podcast and hear a bunch more of our episodes by heading over to lasvegas.citycast.fm. That's where you'll find us Monday through Friday. You can also sign up for our amazing daily newsletter. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Till then, stay lucky. I wish Jacob's first name was Willie, because then I'd call him Local Policy Wonk Willie. But it's not. It's Jacob. So we're stuck with it.
No. Yeah. Sorry about that.